In a cafe in the heart of Birmingham, a woman and man sit opposite one another. They're deep in discussion as the world passes by outside the window. It is the summer of 1942 and the war is now truly a world war. From North Africa to the Pacific Islands, fighting rages. Germany and Britain are firebombing each other's cities in an effort to destroy their enemies' war machines and break the will of their peoples. But in this quiet cafe, it's just another sleepy afternoon. The couple discuss books, films, and of course, the war. They enjoy each other's company. She finds him tactful, thoughtful, and cultured. She is someone he can discuss his feelings with. But they haven't come here for camaraderie or romance. He slips her a slim cardboard file, which she calmly places into her bag. They finish their tea and get up to leave. As they step into the street, they part cordially and go their separate ways.
Very nice to meet you.
The atomic spy, Klaus Fuchs, has just met his new handler, my great aunt, who he knows simply as Sonia. The file he has just transferred to her contains dozens of pages of top secret documents. Secrets with the power to change the world. From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is season 2 of The Bomb. Episode 4, A Stable Bond. Ursula Kaczynski is the Soviet Union's station chief for illegal espionage in the UK. She is tapped into the veins of Britain's military, political, and scientific establishments. Atomic physicist Klaus Fuchs is her prize catch. As young idealists in Germany, they both dreamed of defeating fascism and ushering in a new society built on equality and peace. Although they never met in their native country, their lives are now intertwined at the centre of a spying mission that's integral to the power play between the world's superpowers. Whether they realise this and can control its outcome is another matter altogether. After their meeting in Birmingham, Ursula returns to her young children and home in Kidlington, just 5 miles outside Oxford. Over the years, I've heard and read so much about Ursula's story, but I wonder what her life was really like. Being a German in England at this time must have been hard enough, but being a German who was spying for the Soviet Union is almost unimaginable. How did she hide her secret? And what impact did her espionage have on the war and on my family? Her youngest son, Peter, now lives in Germany.
This is the family. Let's look at this one.
That's the family.
So there's a lovely photo of Ursula and her
Michael.
Three children.
No, there's Michael, Nina and me. Yes, it's she and her three children.
That's lovely. She looks very beautiful there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't she?
Yes, true. Yeah.
I met Peter at his apartment in Berlin, but he remembers his early life in the UK vividly.
You know, I remember living in the countryside. I remember living in the Furze farmhouse. It's a big old house built of Cotswold stone, 200 years old or so. And we moved into that place when I was 4 years of age.
Yeah.
I know exactly the room I stayed in and the house where I slept. I even remember Mark being there once.
Really?
Mark came on a holiday or so as a little boy.
My uncle Mark.
Yes, your uncle.
Yes, my uncle.
I remember walking out after breakfast with my apron on, seeing the sun rising over the shed.
Wow.
Wonderful sunny days. And then I also remember how we walked off and collected frogs.
Did you?
Yeah, we collected frogs for some reason, yeah.
So it was a very beautiful place to live, was it?
In my memories, much more so, of course,
yeah.
You know. It was
yeah.
the most beautiful place of the whole world.
Really?
And other English people told me, well, Cotswolds really are the most English part of England. And that's, I guess it's true in a sense.
The Cotswolds, yeah, I can see that.
The landscape of the Cotswolds provides the quintessential image of England you might find on a biscuit tin lid. winding country lanes and cottages of honey-coloured stone. There's a rural atmosphere here, a small Church of England primary school, a cricket team. And of course, there's a typically friendly and inquisitive rural community. People here have certainly noticed the unusual newcomer, Mrs. Burton, but she melds straight in.
Being really at home and receiving guests like any other English person would receive guests.
Yes.
And kind of slight Scottish accent.
People thought she was Scottish.
Yes.
She has, in fact, recently arrived from Switzerland, where she was spying for the Russians from her Alpine chalet. Switzerland is technically neutral in the war, but it's full of spies, spying on other spies. The Nazis started closing in on her, and her network was at risk of being compromised, so she fled with her children to the UK. In the claustrophobic small rural community, people may gossip, but British discretion stops anyone being too direct. And her gender proves a useful distraction. Ursula Burton is just another woman getting by, making a new home in the upheaval of war.
She was very much part of the community, and also she saw to it that my sister and I, that we both go to school. She saw to it that another couple who had two children my age, that they took us along by car to the school in Chipping Norton, which was 3 or 4 miles away. So she was quite a sociable person, really.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. She always looked after us growing up, you know. It's really, we were simply a very normal family.
She keeps her bungalow tidy, tends the garden, bakes great scones. She even invites in lodgers who are in need of a place to stay.
There was a couple in Chipping Norton, I don't know how she came to know of them, a newly married couple who were short of money. And so my mother told them, well, why don't you move in with us? You could do housework for me so that I have more free time. And so they came and lived with us, I don't know for how long, half a year or a year or so, which in a sense is quite astonishing because my mother, of course, had a second life.
Yeah.
With her radio secret stuff, which she sent to Moscow.
A nice little euphemism for the second life of Mrs. Burton. In the lining of her handbag, she has a miniature camera for creating microdot photographs. And in the bedroom wardrobe, she has a radio transmitter she built herself.
Greetings, comrade.
Remember Alexander Vasilyev, the former KGB agent and author on KGB history?
She's described as not simply an agent. She's described as our illegal station chief, our illegal resident. Now, this is big. It's not just an agent. So she was running a network of agents in Britain. She was, at the top.
But what's your sense of how important, how significant she was?
People like her, they were very important to the Soviets during the war because the Soviet Union was the main force in the war against Germany in Europe. At that time, everyone knew that. They don't know it today, but at that time, they knew it. And there was a lot of sympathy towards the Soviet Union, and they were helping. So Ursula did what she could do. She was important.
It's true. There is sympathy for the Soviet Union, particularly among the left. But the British government is much more cautious. The Soviets may be taking the fight to the Nazis, but since Russia's 1917 revolution, in which communists violently overthrew the Tsar, the British establishment has been deeply suspicious, if not hostile, to Russia. Ursula is an illegal station chief, meaning she has no formal connection to the Soviet embassy. There's no diplomatic immunity she can fall behind if rumbled. On the train ride home from her meeting with Fuchs, Ursula looks out on the rural outskirts of Banbury. It's a pleasant spot. Quiet, scenic, and surrounded by rolling farmland. And it's halfway between Oxford and Birmingham. For the next year, this will become her regular rendezvous point with physicist Klaus Fuchs.
It gives them an opportunity to see if either one of them is being followed.
Mike Rossiter is author of The Spy Who Changed the World.
Because it's a lot easier to spot if you're being followed down a country lane in the middle of the countryside than if you're meeting in a restaurant in a city centre.
The arrangement is simple but thorough. On a weekend morning, Ursula catches the train to Banbury and then cycles out of town along the country lanes. Her bike has a comfortable wicker child seat with a cushion she's embellished with daisies on a green background. She trails off the road onto a small path that runs across a meadow and to the edge of a small woodland. She parks her bike next to a tree. It's the same tree every time, where she digs among the roots and buries a note which says where to meet and when. The same afternoon, Klaus Fuchs arrives from Birmingham, along with his documents. He digs up the note, and a little later finds Ursula at the meeting place, a new one each time. Then they head out into the country lanes.
Walking arm in arm, like an old established principle of illicit meetings. Like they were lovers, you know, walking along the lane.
Author Nancy Thorndike Greenspan.
At one point, he gave her 100 pages. And it was never clear what was contained in it, but he did give her a lot of information. That is sure. He would ask her some questions, what they wanted or did they understand X, Y, and Z. She had a transmitter at her house. She would transmit those questions. She would get the answers back and give him the answers. So there was a back and forth that way with Moscow Center. That's where she was communicating with.
Do you know, one thing I've wondered is whether Ursula knew how significant the material was, because she's obviously, you know, she's been doing this with different people in different countries for years, but this is definitely the most significant information that she's passing along. Do you think she knew that at the time?
I think she did, because I think she received feedback from Moscow Center saying, this is great, you know, keep getting more, this is good.
When Fuchs first started providing intel, they knew it was important, but they were bogged down with the immediate existential threat from the Nazi invasion. The scientists were interested, but Stalin and his generals were fighting for their survival. But now times are changing. David Holloway is a historian at Stanford University and author of Stalin and the Bomb.
In September of 1942, Stalin signs a decree setting up a small lab to investigate whether or not a fission bomb would be possible. And at that point, yes, Fuchs's information becomes very important. And of course, it has contributed to the flow of intelligence coming in that prompted Stalin's decision. He was working on gaseous diffusion method of isotope separation, but he got a query about the electromagnetic method of separating the uranium isotopes, and that made him conclude that the Russians were getting information from some other source as well, and that the Soviet scientists are paying attention. And so he's getting questions that reflect the interest of the scientists. So I think that probably made him feel more useful, actually, and more confident that the Soviet Union was making good use of the information that he was supplying.
Klaus had asked his previous handler, Simon Kramer, to make sure his files made it onto the desk of Stalin. He knows where power lies in Moscow. Kramer promised he would do what he could, which in reality was not much. But now Stalin is definitely listening. Fuchs receives a list of 12 pieces of information Russia urgently needs. Sonia is the intermediary. She delivers the message on one of their trysts in Banbury, and at their next meeting, Fuchs returns with everything he knows about the Tube Alloys project and the Allies' nuclear ambitions. Ursula and Fuchs are now intimately entwined at the heart of the most important espionage mission on the planet. They've come a long way from battling Nazi students in Kiel or selling Marxist literature on the streets of Berlin.
They liked each other, and it was a real treat. They were more or less the same age, and she was a nice young woman that he could form a certain kind of friendship and rapport with, and they did.
Ursula later wrote, "Nobody who did not live in such isolation can guess how precious these meetings with a fellow German comrade were."
Fuchs is got the opportunity now to talk to somebody who's got a similar experience of being in the German Communist Party, with knowledge of everything that's happening in it, the people who are active in it. They've both got interests in books, literature, films, which they talk about. They enjoy talking about German culture, German literature.
Fuchs and Ursula may enjoy each other's company and respect each other, but they are not mates. She's his handler. It's a unique kind of relationship.
I was trained the same way as Putin was at exactly at the same time. Because he graduated from the KGB spy school in 1985, and I joined it in 1985. And we had the same training. We had the same textbooks, same instructors, same lectures.
So Alexander Vasilyev knows a thing or two about spycraft.
One of my instructors was an operative who was handling Klaus Fuchs. To be a good spy, you have to be a very nice person. Seriously, I mean, I was trained to be a nice person by the KGB.
Really?
Yeah, I was, yeah, for 2 years. I am Mr. Nice now.
But, you do seem very nice.
Yeah, well, thank you. I am.
What does that involve? How do they train you to do that?
Most important thing was to be able to talk to people on a human level. Because, you know, agents are people. They're human beings. They have families. They have their own problems. They have children, financial problems, as well as political problems. And how their political views may change. So she needed, you know, Ursula Kuczynski to consider all this, to talk people about all these problems. This is how I was trained. When you are meeting with your agent, first of all, don't talk about secrets. Talk about human stuff. How are you? How is your family? You need to talk to your agents about things which are important to them.
Ursula and Klaus no doubt feel a great affinity for one another, but she is a first-class spy, station chief for the Soviet illegal spy ring in the UK, handling a whole network of agents. Being nice, building trust, well, that's part of the job, and she's good at it. But what about Britain's intelligence services? When Ursula arrived in the UK more than a year and a half ago, she'd been formally designated a potential threat. Her brother Jürgen is also well known to MI5. And Fuchs is no stranger to his house. So how come they don't join the dots?
Quite obviously, MI5's prime consideration in the late 1930s was Nazi espionage.
Nigel West is an expert and author on the history of British intelligence, who also interviewed my great-uncle Jürgen when he was still alive.
And so where there were people of leftist leanings, that was considered to be a bit of an asset in an environment which was opposed to fascism. The security service had very little understanding of Soviet intelligence operations conducted at that time in the United Kingdom. In my discussions with Jürgen, he insisted to me that although he had a relationship with the Soviet military intelligence service, he was neither an officer, nor an agent, nor an intermediary, nor a talent spotter, nor a case officer. The Austrian Communist Party and the German Communist Party were legitimate organizations that existed in the United Kingdom, that flourished, that had a relationship with the security service and with Scotland Yard Special Branch. And there was nothing particularly sinister with these organizations that were stacked full of very committed anti-fascists.
And as for Ursula, they may have marked her card when she arrived in the country, but they simply don't have anything on her. They have no idea that Mrs. Burton of the Cotswolds is running agents across the country and regularly communicating with Moscow.
The issue of MI5's relationship with Ursula is complex. The only way that she could have been detected would have been surveillance on the Soviet military intelligence staff at the embassy, but at that time there was no surveillance applied to them because the security service, MI5, was fully engaged in watching Italians, Germans and Austrians. So there were just insufficient resources and a complete lack of evidence.
So it's not Fuchs's association with my family that brings him to the attention of the British authorities. It's a security clearance request from the top-secret nuclear development project, codenamed Tube Alloys. The government asks MI5 what they have on Fuchs. But because the Tube Alloys project is so shrouded in secrecy, MI5 have no idea just how sensitive Fuchs's role will be. And this is the point at which they make a fatal error of judgment.
One of the MI5 agents said to the other, look at this. This is a problem. He has some communist leanings, or he did, maybe, because they still didn't know if it was true or not. And the other one said, well, do we need to hire him? The response was, well, you know, if we did and he's spying, do we mind if the information went to the Russians? It's not going to go to the Germans.
The answer is yes, they need him. Churchill has gambled, and gambled big on the atom bomb. And Fuchs has proven himself an invaluable card in his deck. He receives his work clearance and then applies for citizenship and to sign the Official Secrets Act. MI5 have more than enough intel as cause for concern, but not enough for the government to take action.
They just decided that they would not pursue this, and they let him sign the document on June the 18th.
Then the next day, somebody in MI5 comes back with a question.
Was Klaus Fuchs the same as the Klaus Fuchs, and that's Klaus spelled with a C rather than a K, was Klaus with a C Fuchs who went to Canada both the same person? Because the Klaus with the C was close friends with Hans Koller when they were in the camp.
Luckily for Klaus Fuchs, Brits are terrible at spelling German names. The confusion over Klaus with a K and Klaus with a C means his association with Soviet agent and spy recruiter Hans Koller slips by the wayside.
No one answered it at all. And who didn't follow up is not clear. It just was not followed up.
By the skin of his teeth, Klaus Fuchs makes it through. As a British citizen and signatory to the Official Secrets Act, he's now fully embedded in the establishment. But his access to information is about to get even greater. The British government is in an awkward dance with the American administration. Britain is leading the field in atomic research. After the Frisch-Pyles memo proved an atomic bomb was possible in theory, and the Maud report then concluded building such a weapon was feasible in wartime, Britain charged full steam ahead. As for the Americans, they dithered.
Roosevelt understood that the British scientists were ahead of the game.
Cindy Kelly is the founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation.
They were ahead of the American efforts, which were sort of stuck in a bureaucratic morass.
But Britain's Tube Alloys is making fast progress. The pressure of war and the threat of Nazi domination is driving the scientists to realise in months what would otherwise take years. Their achievements gift Churchill a card he can play to pressure America's president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, to join the war.
Churchill was upset with Roosevelt for not taking a pro-British stance. And Roosevelt had his hands full. The country was very isolationist. I mean, the people who did not want America to be involved in what they thought was a European affair. Roosevelt's hands were tied with respect to sort of entering the war early.
Churchill knows that if Britain is going to launch a campaign on the European mainland, he needs America's might on his side.
And Roosevelt was approaching Churchill about collaborating on an atomic bomb. But Churchill ignored him. And one theory is that Churchill wanted to use that expertise and advanced work that the British scientists had been doing as a lever to get Roosevelt in the war itself.
Churchill is cunning in the extreme. but this time he's overplayed his hand. The Americans kick into action and forge ahead with their own atomic program. It also has a distracting name, the Manhattan Project. The resources they throw at the job dwarf anything Britain can muster.
The dynamics changed. The seesaw balance tipped, and Americans surged ahead with their commitment, with their resources, bringing in American industry, the major corporations who had great experience with challenging engineering and chemical and other issues were brought in to help solve the problem.
The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor drags the Americans into the war anyway, and by 1942, they've taken the lead in atomic research. Britain is in danger of being sidelined completely. The Americans are spending eye-watering amounts of money, mobilising the full force of their industry.
There's a sudden fear amongst the British that they're going to be cut out of the project altogether. This is fantastically frightening, and it creates a massive sense of crisis.
The minister in charge of tube alloys visits America and is stunned by what he sees. He warns the government, "We must face the fact that our pioneering work is a dwindling asset. We now have a real contribution to make to a merger." Churchill has to do some serious backpedalling. But luckily, he's fond of late-night drinking sessions and games of snooker.
Churchill practically moved into the White House for like 3 weeks or so, padded around in his bathrobe and slippers, and stayed up late at night with cigar and brandy, bonding with Roosevelt in December of 1941. Eleanor Roosevelt got very upset because Churchill hardly slept and he drank a lot. And he would keep Roosevelt charmed and you know, they had a great time together.
So she wasn't happy about it. That's funny.
No, she wanted her husband to be abed and sleeping, not staying up drinking and chatting and having great gay old time.
Wars are often seen through the power dynamics of nations, the battle of ideologies. But it's often personal relationships that shape the course of history. Churchill understands this all too well, and his sessions drinking brandy by the fire with Roosevelt into the early hours of the morning prove invaluable to Britain's ambitions to stay relevant in the race for an atomic bomb. In the summer of 1943, the two leaders meet at the Quebec Conference in Canada.
Without the knowledge of Congress, they made a pact to pool their efforts on the atomic bomb and not use it without each other's consent and not to share information with third parties, other people, other countries.
Though in reality, the agreement is a one-way street headed in the direction of the United States. But at least the Brits are involved. The Russians, on the other hand, are kept well and truly in the cold. They might be allies while fighting the Nazis, but the West is already planning for the post-war world, and Stalin's Russia is no friend there. For Klaus Fuchs, this is a betrayal of the country that's fighting the hardest and suffering the most in the face of fascism. His personal conviction is that Moscow needs to know everything about the Allies' atomic research. The agreement made in Quebec won't enter the public domain for more than a decade. But the ink has barely dried when Fuchs informs Ursula, who in turn informs Moscow. The Vice President of the United States doesn't know what's going on, but Stalin does. Fuchs has already handed over hundreds of pages of documents, pretty much the sum total of research the Brits have produced on the subject. But his capacity to assist the Russians is about to get even more significant. Klaus Fuchs is going to relocate across the Atlantic to New York. Britain's tube alloys is being wound down and merged into America's much bigger Manhattan Project, led by the formidable General Groves.
He was amazingly intelligent, ambitious, and determined to make this work. He was self-confident. He told friends, "If I can't do the job, no one man can." So he was very controlling. He gave himself 1 hour to decide even the most complex problems. And he said, The time to worry about a problem is before you make the decision, not afterwards. You go out and play tennis after making these hundreds of millions of dollars worth of decisions.
General Groves is a force to be reckoned with. In the run-up to America's involvement in the war, he was in charge of the Army's huge mobilization effort, constructing camps, air bases, and hospitals, and drawing up munitions plans. He's a man who can make the seemingly impossible possible. But there's a problem. He's also an Anglophobe.
He was not at all welcoming of opening the Manhattan Project to British scientists.
General Groves is convinced the Americans could and should go it alone. But President Roosevelt has shaken hands on it with his old drinking pal, Winston Churchill. A disgruntled Groves concedes and agrees to some 60 British scientists coming on board his programme. But he insists that British intelligence provide a detailed security clearance on every member of the team.
The Department of Industrial and Scientific Research, that's now responsible for tube alloys, draws up a list of all of the scientists that they want to get out there and, to be very, very crude about it, get as far up that project as they can.
The lead scientist on Britain's tube alloys programme visits America and is gobsmacked by what he finds.
He says it is impossible to describe the extent of the advances that are being made in the United States. If we are going to make any efforts of our own, it's vital to us that we get as much information out of this project as we possibly can. This set of scientists and people are the mechanism by which the British are going to do it.
Britain doesn't just want to help the Americans build the bomb so they can defeat the Nazis. The memory of America's isolationism after the First World War hasn't faded. What if the same happens after the Second World War and Britain has to fight Russia alone? Britain and America may be allies, but that doesn't mean they trust each other. Britain wants its own bomb as soon as possible. And Fuchs is a key component in their calculations.
So, as a matter of form, and I think it really is just covering their backs, they send a memo to MI5 saying we need a security clearance for Fuchs. And they say in the memo, we'd like a reply tomorrow. There's almost no time.
MI5 are furious that they are only being consulted at the 11th hour. To add insult to injury, they're shocked to find he's been given British citizenship, despite the concerns they raised. When the file ends up in front of MI5's Michael Serpel, an old communist hunter and Soviet expert, he's incredulous and says there is no way Fuchs should be given a security clearance.
It's all bluster, because Fuchs's visit or trip to New York is a fait accompli. The urgency that is behind this whole episode and the level of national interest that is involved in these British scientists becoming as closely involved to the Manhattan Project as they can, is literally completely overriding.
MI5 Serpel is furious, and the coordinator of the UK's nuclear bomb programme, Michael Perrin, is also worried. He knows that Fuchs is a talented genius and a huge security liability. He writes to MI5 saying,
"This is a very important matter vis-à-vis the Americans, and I want to be quite sure that we do not slip up in any way."
But once again, British bureaucratic incompetence intervenes in Fuchs's favour. Perrin's request for MI5 assurances, for some reason, doesn't reach the forensic eye of Michael Serpel. It goes to a different department, not staffed by Russia experts. They conclude
that it was safer for Klaus to be in the U.S., away from his friends in London, like Jurgen Kaczynski, that he wouldn't be able to make contact with U.S. communists very easily there, and that he would not become politically active.
As far as intelligence blunders go, this is about as big as they get. Fuchs makes one more visit to Agent Sonia. It's winter and the air is bitingly cold. As they stroll through the grey country lanes of Oxfordshire, Klaus explains that he will be leaving within days. Sonia tells him she used to live in New York and assures him that although he may be leaving his comrades in the UK, he'll have no problems at all making contact with communists in America. She knows just the spot for a rendezvous with his new handler. And then my great aunt Ursula passes on one final message from Moscow.
The meeting's location and arrangements in New York are clear. Please give our thanks. Tell him we hope that his collaboration with us in the new place will be as successful as it was in England.
The British establishment has just planted the Russians' most valuable spy into the heart of the American-led nuclear program. It's a fuse that the Brits can no longer put out. Next time on The Bomb.
They said to Michael Perrin, don't mention his political proclivities in the U.S. Don't let him know he's had communist ties.
People in Moscow are going crazy. Klaus Fuchs was the source of information on The Bomb, and they lost him.
He's not here anymore. He's somewhere on a boat. He left on a boat.
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Our producer in Berlin was Sabine Sherek, with additional performances by David Hounslow. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Eloise Whitmore. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.